Ah, yes. The new Channel 9. Really like it. Fast. Interesting. UI is nice. A lot of Ajax going on, which is cool. Wonder why so much Ajax. Anyway, let's go find out, huh? Let's go talk to the guys who built this. Building 18 we are. You know this office. You've seen it before. Come on.
Alternating
weeks. Hey. Whoa, what's up, guys?
Of meeting or
here we are.
Hey,
dev people. Where's Duncan?
Duncan went to get coffee.
Yeah.
Man, he drinks a lot of coffee, doesn't he?
Well.
But he doesn't really seem very jittery. It's amazing. He's mellow.
Well, it's because he drinks so much coffee that it's, he needs that to get.
Counteracts the effect,
yes,
huh?
Yes.
Cool. So, we can start talking before Duncan gets here, right?
Yeah.
You coding, Eric?
Not at the moment, but yeah. I'm working on it.
It's a test server, man.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so I deployed 9 last week and...
Who are you, first of all?
Oh,
come on.
I'm Sampy, by the way.
C9 Sampy.
C9 Sampy.
And we call you Sampy here, too.
You call me Sampy here. Oh. My wife called me Mike Sampson. My parents call me that, but pretty much nobody else.
Your wife doesn't call you Sampy?
No.
Wow.
No, she actually, some people call her Mrs. Sampy, and she really hates that. those people, I pity those people. Anyway, so I pushed 9 out last week, and there was an issue with 3.5 SP1. I had it on my dev machine. It wasn't on the servers, and that caused some shenanigans. And so someone asked, like, you know, well, don't you have a test server?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, you know, we probably should get a machine without SP1 installed on it. And Eric had this laptop sitting in his office.
Nice.
And so I grabbed it, updated it on my machine, and then tested it on the test server, and it worked. And so,
cool.
Shipped.
Yeah, I shipped it. So it worked the second time.
So you're a new face. Now, I have to point out, you all have really cool t-shirts. I mean, right on, yeah. That's what, lawn mowing on Mars, or what? Oh,
crop circles.
So who are you?
I'm Nathan, kind of the newish guy.
Uh-huh.
So.
You're writing code? Just hanging out?
Not breaking too much.
Cool, man. Excellent. You came into pretty much the code base in a relatively stable state. Yes?
Yeah.
Excellent,
good
man.
Save.
Good save. Eric?
I'm Eric, human compiler.
Nice. That's human compiler because you're compiling children? Is that the idea?
Yes. Yeah. No, actually it was Adam Kinney, who used to be on Channel 9, that gave me that name. I don't know, I used to, when we were both learning .NET, like when it first came out as a tech preview, I'd stand behind his shoulder and sometimes it'd be like, hey, you might want to change that because it's going to break. And he'd be like, yeah, whatever, and build and it would break. So,
nice. And so what is that organic molecule on your shirt?
It's caffeine.
Nice. Perfect. Yeah. Do you drink coffee?
Nope.
Oh, you go for the hard stuff.
Yep.
Coffee's so inefficient.
Yeah. Excellent. So this is a going deep episode, finally, of the great work you guys have done, kind of learning sort of the nitty-gritty details of what you guys have implemented.
Yeah.
But before we get there, since Duncan is still out, I wanted to address something that the Niners have been kind of asking for, is learn a little bit more about the people. You know, why did you come to Microsoft? What's your story, right? So we can get that over. There he is.
Dude.
Caffeine in hand.
You're like 2 minutes early.
So who are you, man?
Duncan.
We know you.
Yes.
And you're from Canada.
I am from Canada. We were introducing ourselves, saying why we came to Microsoft.
That's a great segue, man.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I started out in Canada with MCS, Microsoft Consulting Services.
Ah.
And I did that for 3 years, building systems, banking systems, financial systems, mortgage systems. And they were all kind of money related.
Hmm.
And then they said, hey, it's time for you to become a manager or a salesperson, because at a certain point in the field, things kind of leveled off and you couldn't just keep coding.
Mm.
So I came to Redmond and I joined MSDN. Did that for a while until they said, we don't want you to just make articles. We want you to be like a PM or something. So I came here. So I get to keep coding.
Nice.
It's all a quest to keep coding.
Quest to keep coding. Yeah. Excellent. That's perfect, man.
It still has Emma Stanton in the name, so it's good.
Good. But that's interesting. We did that for a political reason. We're tied to MSDN.
We're into the same people.
We're loosely tethered.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. What's your story, Sampy?
So I came to Microsoft 2 times before I worked here full time. My sophomore and junior year of college, I did an internship out here as an SDET, software design engineer and test, with the Visual Basic team.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back out the next summer and became an SDE, or software design engineer dev, because I was good at writing like the platform for tests, but I was a pretty horrible tester. And so I became a dev instead. And
that explains so many things.
It does, doesn't it? Then after that, I came back full-time on Visual Basic. I worked on Visual Studio 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I did the click once integration into Visual Studio. So if you ever pull up the publish property page of Visual Studio, that's pretty much all me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did that. And after Visual 2005 shipped, I worked a little bit on planning for 2008, but then came over here and do this now.
Outstanding.
So, yeah.
Cool. You're on, dude.
On the spot.
Developers are either very gregarious or very shy. It's an interesting group.
It's almost like they're real people.
Yeah, you mean you are human. So what's your story, man?
So a few years back, I was working at a university up the road as their web guy.
Okay.
And that was getting kind of boring, so I had a chance to interview as a contractor up here.
Uh-huh.
The only reason why I really did is because of Channel 9.
Nice.
It's really interesting.
All right, so, man.
Because I was one of those anti-Microsoft guys, but it got me kind of interested. Some of the first IIS 7 videos and stuff. Ended up being a contractor MSN for a few months, FTE for a few years, and then came over here.
Excellent. Good. And so you thought, Mike, when you came into the Death Star and realized that it's actually kind of nice inside. You know, it's not hard. Darth Vader's actually pretty cool. Right on. Mr. Porter.
So I started coding in high school, which was surprising because I come from a town of about 9,000 people with one high school. But we had one teacher that was really, really into programming. And so we learned Pascal and VB4 and a few other things. And at that point, I was like, I need to go work at Microsoft. So since high school, I've been trying to figure out how to do that. But I kind of delayed myself in that I went through about 3 semesters of college doing computer science and then was like, I don't really dig learning like this. So I dropped out and joined a local ISP where I did tech support and built small web apps for local businesses, and then moved up through there through a few different companies, and then not 3 years ago, but close, got a job here and been here.
Totally. Yeah, I remember that. You joined Channel 9 when I was still writing code, way back on the now defunct code base.
Yeah.
Which leads us nicely into the topic of conversation for today's Going Deep. It's the what do you call it? You call it the Evangelism Network platform, or what's the name of this code base you guys have created?
Evnet. We don't really call it all that much. But in the code stuff, it's Evnet. That's the name of the solution, the project, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually called 9. I mean, the actual solution file we open for all of the sites is 9. The web project for all the sites is Channel 9.
Nice.
And that's what it was. Even when we were building it, it started out being called 10 because we built 10 first when 9 was running totally separately, and we weren't taking on the challenge of rebuilding 9 yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as we realized this is going to be multiple things, it all became 9.
Excellent. Cool.
I don't remember. Actually, I don't think we met and discussed that or anything.
Well, we had. That was back when we had each site had its own web project.
That's true. And then we decided to get rid of them all.
Yeah, there's the Mnet Core DLL, and then you had like a Channel 8 web project and a Channel 10 web project. Mm-hmm. And then I think Edge wasn't around then. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we figured out some clever tricks. That I think we talked about the overriding and stuff in some of the
dev directories,
which I'm sure will be a link to like next to my head over there.
Mm-hmm.
don't point.
Well,
I'm putting Charles on the spot.
No, I won't be editing this file, but I no. got you. It'll be in the text.
Yes, it'll be in the text.
So pointing actually works.
I'm being cheesy. Anyway, so then we consolidate all of them, and depending on which config you pick in Visual Studio, they're all solution configs, you'll get each one of the five different sites in four different versions, debug, release, staging, or production.
Excellent.
So that's a big giant drop down when that comes down. But,
So one of the things to ask, you know, sort of the obvious question would be, you know, why was a decision made to evolve the code base completely? I mean, we can talk about, and everybody knows the Frankensteinian nature of the old code base, but I mean, it's actually a big deal to say, let's write it from scratch.
It is. So, part of this actually probably goes back to, like, Rob Howard and the way a lot of the original ASP.NET forums code was done and the templating and things like that. The same sort of thing happened around the .txt blogging platform that was out there that eventually got merged into Community Server as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was the kind of code where when you switched to the framework 2, it didn't even compile. It wasn't even compatible. You basically would have to redo a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision we had wasn't really evolving the Channel 9 code base into the new thing. It was, do we build a new one using Community Server, or do we build a new one ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
That was really the decision we were stuck with. When I came in, we had Microsoft Gadgets, and we had Channel 9. Do we have anything else?
That was it.
And Microsoft Gadgets was built on Community Server, and Channel 9 was built on what Channel 9 was built on, which was an assortment of things. So we, at that time, we had 5 weeks to launch 10, and we spent a little while with the Community Server code base trying to decide if we could change it in enough ways to produce the look we wanted for 10
mm-hmm.
and the functionality that we wanted for 10. And a lot of that site was driven by the look. We had comps in mind. Adam Kinney was involved. He had a very specific idea of what he wanted the site to do and how it should act, mm-hmm. and we decided we couldn't do it. We decided we couldn't make Community Server do what we wanted at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they've since then done a lot of stuff, so I'm not saying it can't. But at the time, we just said, well, we can't. So we have 5 weeks. I think we made Jeff almost throw up when we said, we're going to just start from scratch, and mm-hmm. we're going to launch our own site in 5 weeks, mm-hmm. which we did. And then from there, we've just kept evolving, because we already had the basics of blog entries, RSS, tags, an admin, you know, all the things that essentially form the basis of Evnet now, we built in that first 5 weeks, so.
Excellent.
Yes, so the old code was never really going to be moved forward. I don't think that ever came up, so.
No, it's still pretty amazing, though, that it was able to scale to.
Yes, and keep running.
And keep running. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, this is going deep. Let's talk about the architecture. I mean, how did you guys, how does this work? What does the new code base look like? I mean, obviously, .NET 2.0,
3.5.
But let's talk about the architecture.
So,
then dig into what each of you did. And then we're going to get into Niner questions.
Okay, I'll do the service layer, and then you can do the UI layer.
All right.
Okay.
Should we close the door?
Yes.
Close the door.
And we should get Sampy at the whiteboard.
Oh, okay.
You like to draw pretty pictures.
I really, really do, actually.
He likes to draw.
I know.
Pictures.
I'm a horrible drawer, and I have horrible handwriting. Let's see how it goes. So there's the ubiquitous cylinder that is the database.
It's actually two cylinders.
It is two cylinders.
Nice.
Now we're going to test my ability to repeat that awesome cylinder.
And it's SQL Server 2005, right?
Yes. It is.
And as of this weekend, 2008.
Nice.
So let's just say, for example, for 9. So we have two memberships,
mm-hmm.
or two databases. One of them is the C9 membership database, and one of them is the C9 database. This is where the reason why we have a separate membership database is it's the way the schema works. We could eventually move to a single unified membership database. And in fact, across the 5 sites, we only have 3 of these.
Mm.
Edge and 8 share a membership database, and 10 and Meg share a membership database. And they're namespace such that your real name in the database is, or my real name in the database is CNET Sampy, but the code abstracts that away from you. So in the database, we have obviously all the tables, but we also have lots and lots of stored procedures. We're pretty stored procedure based for almost everything, mostly because we didn't really have anything else when we first wrote it. We pretty much, I mean, there was no link, there was no any of that, and
mm-hmm.
so and the service layer is built on a couple of assumptions that you use stored procedures, and so I'll explain that now. So we have basically the base service class that does a couple of core things for you. It starts and it manages connections and transactions. It lets you get command objects. And so say you want to retrieve an entry, you would, you know, you get like retrieve, entry, things like by parameters. And I'll let Eric talk about entry retrieve parameters. And no one correct my spelling, please. And so you would say, I want this stored procedure, and the service layer will figure out, well, he means en underscore whatever he wrote there, and I'll then you get back the command object, and he will put the connection and the transaction in for you and stuff. And so base service basically kind of works to abstract away a lot of the talking to SQL directly stuff for you. And then built on that, you just have the services. And so you have like the entry service, which gets entries. You have like the tag service, which gets tags. And these are all, you create instances of them. And so for convenience, we have a bunch of static classes. So if you want to get all the entries by SAMPI, you could say entries.retrieve, you know, new user, and pass SAMPI as the username. Okay. And then what would happen there is that you would call the static method on entries. Inside there, he'd create a new entry service, which would handle the connection and the transaction, call into base service to get the command. Eventually, it would make it all the way down to the database, where it actually run it for you, and then move its way back up here.
The static classes also bring together different services. So if you have multiple things that you want to mess with, you just can attach them all to each other and they all work in the same transaction or use the same connection.
That's true, yeah. Whenever you construct one of these, you can pass it another one and it will pick up that connection and transaction that's already using. For example, the entry object has a tags parameter that works off the that has the tags for that entry. In order to get them, you've got to use the tag service. Mm-hmm. And so when you call an entries method, you may interact with the tag service, you may interact with the user's service, all that, because that an entry has those properties. And I guess before I leave the service layer, there is one other interesting thing, which is that the way we get lists and individual entries. And so we cache things for performance, but what we do is, so say I did that query I just mentioned a minute ago. I want to get all the entries by SAMPI. Mm-hmm. What we actually cache is, I can't remember what the name of the class, is it an entry retrieve collection, ERC? Yeah. So we get the special object that's entry retrieve collection, which is actually just a list of IDs. So this is just a whole bunch of like entry IDs. And then this is cached as the result of the query.
Mm.
Then what we do is for each ID, we make a query to get that entry.
Sure.
And so say the entries are like, you know, boringly 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Mm-hmm.
We'll actually make a separate service call to get 1, 2, 3, and 4. If it's the first time anyone has gotten them, it's 4 database calls and it's kind of lame. But say I'm looking for all the entries in the coffee house. Mm-hmm. I want to do another ERC. And say 2 and 4 are coffee house threads. So this gets back like 2, 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
For the coffee house one, we store that list. But then when we go to get the individual entries, this comes out of cache and this comes out of cache. And I only have to do 2 database calls. And so everything kind of lives in the database or in cache as its own independent unit that they're linked together. Mm. So that way, when you get, eventually over time, once an entry kind of makes it into memory and we've gotten it once from the database, we never go get it again. We just get it once. And then
it's really great for the coffee house. It's so fast moving. Like the order of those entries changes constantly because it's ordered by last comment date.
Mm.
So that list has to get blown away constantly. So instead of blowing away every single entry, though, if only one of them changed, that's the only one we have to blow away, and then we get the list again. So it makes the stored procedure really simple, too. You don't have to really... You only do joins for your wares.
Mm-hmm.
You don't do joins to actually get other fields. And it makes it easy and consistent, because making a new stored procedure, you only have to return IDs all the time. So it's very, very nice.
That's good. Actually, this obviously has a dramatic... effect on performance.
Yes.
Yeah.
It has a good effect on ongoing performance, but everyone was about to bring this up. It has a bad effect on startup performance. Because the initial time somebody hits the coffee house, the number of database requests we do is very, very high. That's something that we don't have a real solution for at the moment. If you went the old way where you'd have like a get forum entries, and that actually brought back all the data in one call, mm-hmm. you'd have a quicker startup time, but on the other hand, you'd be getting all that data every time. Mm-hmm. So we're optimized for the long running process sort of thing. We're not really optimized for that initial startup.
And when we launched Channel 9 version 4, that was also multiplied across every web node.
Yes.
Which goes into the next performance thing that we fixed that mm-hmm. one of these guys can talk about of mm-hmm. how you get it so that each web node doesn't make that request for all that data when the app starts up because it was killing our SQL
Server
because
so
they were all attacking it at once.
That's what happened is.
You're going to need to write that down. You need to wipe this to us.
I do.
Cool.
So basically the way, so this actually gets into a random comment I made in some other thread about how we use locking to improve performance. And
yes.
this is how we do it. So what was happening was, so you'd have nodes 1, 2, and 3. And then you have, like, say, users on each one. And say they're all, you know, tabs of IE in Jamie's browser, and he wants to get the coffee house, and he wants it now. What's happening is the first guy comes in on web node 1, and he says, I want the coffee house. So what it does is, I obviously need to get the list of coffeehouse entries, and so mm-hmm. I fire off the API request. That's where procedure is not crazy fast. It, you know, it's because of the way things work, it ends up being slightly, you know, taking at least a second or two. The problem is, in that second or two, another person comes in and wants the coffeehouse. So the service layer, mm-hmm. in parallel, looks in and says, "Oh, it's not in cache. I need to make a database request." Same thing happens for C. Same thing happens for all three of these guys. Same thing happens for all three of these guys. And so now you have a stored procedure that's, you know, takes a second or two to run, but now it's running 9 times.
Mm-hmm.
And your hosting provider sends you an email and says, why is your SQL Server on fire?
Yeah.
And that's not good. So we can't really, as of yet, I'll let Eric talk about this in a second, we can't really coordinate across the nodes. But ideally what we want is, the whole point of cache is that you only ask once, but because mm-hmm. of this slight delay and the initial rush, it never, you have a bunch of asks for the same thing.
Mm.
So what we do is in the service layer, we, on these retrieve calls, we actually do a lock and based on the cache key for what you're looking for. And so we compute the unique cache key, and then we call into this lock service that we wrote, and it says, give me a lock on this cache key. And then you lock on it, and then you go in and you, you actually do the retrieve and you put it in cache.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you exit the lock, and then you exit the lock such that other people who are asking the exact same question as you have to wait for you to get your answer. And so basically you get lock is the algorithm. So you get lock, then you do a lock. And then actually the first thing you have to do is check cache. Actually do that here too. Because, and then you get it. Cache it, and then you leave a lock. And the reason why you have to check the cache first is if you weren't first,
mm-hmm.
so say guy A comes in, he gets through, and he does all the work. But while he's still getting it, user B comes in, he gets stuck on the lock.
Sure.
That's what we want to happen. But if he doesn't recheck the cache when he gets back in, he's just going to repeat all of A's work. The idea is A's already done. He's put in the cache for you.
Yeah.
So the first thing you should do once you get the lock is like, did somebody beat me to it? Am I not, you know, the first person? And if they did, you break out. If not, you have to do the work. You do the work and you keep going. And so what that did is, first off, the database server runs at something ridiculously small, like 30 or 40% of CPU now because you don't have, I say three here each, but it was much more than that. You don't have huge amounts of connections being opened just because a bunch of concurrent requests came to the web server.
Mm-hmm.
And so by blocking and essentially forcing people to wait, you actually get better performance because the problem is you're overwhelming the database. So if you can keep its load down, it can execute these longer queries efficiently. It doesn't get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up being faster even though you have to wait, which is funny, but works.
And then the next step is to implement velocity.
Yes.
So that will take us a step further and make it so that
mm-hmm.
even only the first web server that makes the request will be the only one that does it.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, see, now we've got it down to one hit per node, which is really awesome. But using velocity and having a central cache store will allow us to only do it once. So, and The other good benefit is when we crash, if the application dies, mm-hmm. we have to ask for all of it again because the cache lives only in each web node.
Yes.
So by having a central cache, then it doesn't die when the app dies. So exactly. we separate it even further and increase our performance even further. And when a web node goes down for whatever reason, it mm-hmm. should not affect performance like at all.
However, though, if the application does die, the cache won't have a lot of meaning giving along. I mean, in other words, you can only add data via the application, right? So if the app dies for, say, 3 minutes, that seldom ever happens, the cache might as well be meaningless.
Not necessarily. Like, we invalidate cache items as uh-huh. on the other nodes. So if we were using Velocity, the cache, the distributed cache, would be still being kept up to date by the other nodes.
Got
right?
it.
So because if no one's hitting the website, then the cache shouldn't change, because that means nothing's changing.
Yeah,
at that point.
True.
So any of the stuff that would normally change, like I've read this versus, you know, another user's read it, that kind of information is cached separately mm-hmm. and added into entries only when we're about to display them.
Awesome.
So because of that, the vast majority of the requests come from cache. I mean, that's obviously the intent.
That's a good idea.
But with the locking that Sampi was just describing, mm-hmm. even people who should be coming from cache but weren't, just because of just the nature of those first requests, you know, we get to make sure they do. So
excellent.
The velocity is going to be a big jump for us.
Indeed. Well, theoretically, according to what they say,
right?
And there's a Channel 9 video coming out someday.
Yeah.
Once they get through their whatever issues they're having with legal.
Right.
is to basically, you guys shouldn't have to do very much work. That's the idea.
Definitely.
I hope that's true.
Part of it, in some ways, we have to undo work we've done okay. right now. So if you're on node 3 and you edit an entry, we have to have some way of making sure that node 1 and 2 immediately pick up your change.
Okay.
Now, in a less sort of user and discussion-focused site, you know, let's say one that was displaying product information or something like that, it would be okay if the product updated 5 minutes later or 10 minutes later. Mm-hmm. But in the case of a forum thread where you just edited your post, you hit F5, you come back to the exact same thread, you need to see your change.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible that between that, you know, post and then the hitting F5, you're going to hit a different server.
Mm-hmm.
So what we actually do is we've sort of written our own multi-node cache invalidation, where when you make a change, we send a node off to the SQL server to this massive list of cache keys and say, this cache key has been invalidated. And so then all the other web nodes pick up that change and invalidate their local cache.
Okay.
That's a whole bunch of work we do. It's not nice. It's heavy intensive to the SQL server. It's a lot of our code. Velocity does all that for us.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially implementing it is mostly going to be ripping all out all the invalidation we're already doing, mm-hmm. but making sure the same results happen. So there are things that we've written that we may not even understand how they get invalidated. We need to make sure that whenever we call Velocity's invalidate, that we do exactly the same.
So the way Velocity is set up right now, since it's just it's an early CTP,
sure.
what we'd have to do is actually set up just one single node to be the single cache service. Because what you have to do is basically have it invalidate in a transaction, which they don't support yet, but they're going to. So if you set up just one cache store, then they all point to the same one, so you're fine. But in the future, as they get transactions working for that, we can actually, you know, when you add a comment, invalidate the cache and retrieve the new one on the next call, all in the same transaction, so that you can have a Velocity cache service on each web node that talk to each other and keep in sync. So
excellent.
It will be cool.
Very cool. And this could span applications, right?
Yeah. I mean, at the moment, the idea would probably be, depending on how we did our cache keys, we could be one Velocity cache distributed across all of our sites, mm-hmm. running on, because they're all on the same servers.
Mm-hmm.
Or we could end up, you could create multiple cache instances, right? So we could create one for each. We'd probably work with the Velocity team to figure out what they think is best.
Sure.
We already met with them once, their architect, to go over what we could use with the CTP,
mm-hmm.
but we have had no time to sit down and cover. So there are things we could do right now, and without having to wait for them to add anything. So we'll see. But, you know, hopefully other things will come out from them, and you'll do a video, and we'll learn how to use fancy new features.
Cool. So one of the things is, one of the big changes with V4 is on the client. I mean, obviously you redid the server. We just talked about that. I'm sure there's a little bit more work that was done there.
Mostly
as well.
Mostly it was just changes to the colors.
Just changes to the colors. But there's an awful lot of work being done with Ajax, or just asynchronous JavaScript. So what's going on there, man? Or, you know, you haven't said anything. Yeah, you say
cool.
something.
That's cool, Eric.
I'm going to yield away.
Let's go. Let's talk about this. And one of the questions Niners have is, why so much Ajax?
Yeah. Why not?
Okay, is that the answer?
It's my answer. I don't know if that's our official answer, but that's my question. Is why not? Not that the mistake we made, basically, was starting from Ajax. So there's this idea that a few people have talked about called hijax, where you start from the non-Ajax side and make sure that things work without JavaScript and do postbacks and submit forms and stuff like that. And then tack on the JavaScript part after the fact. And we probably should have done that. But instead we started at the Ajax side and now we're going back and making it so that certain things work without it.
Sure.
Makes it nice for things that don't have JavaScript enabled, but we're trying to cover as many people as we can, and most people have browsers that support JavaScript. Phones are the only other side to that, but you know, eventually we'll get to a phone-specific interface anyway. So
that's the answer, and then we can move on to the implementation.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
So iScript control is your friend. iScript control. So this is... So basically we chose, there's two routes you can go with ASP.NET, Ajax, or Atlas, as I'll call it, because it's easier to say. There's the update panel route, which makes things very easy. You can take all of your code that used to work in the postback model and shove it into an update control, and ASP.NET manages all the view state and all of the, how it calls back from the client for you. Mm-hmm. So just take a page that used to work by posting back and drop it in, and it just works, and it's Ajax-y. The problem with that is the good part about that is the problem with it is the view state, because it gets huge. Yeah. So
the requests are giant.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we decided the bandwidth is a good thing to save, so we went the custom control route, which is where you actually build your own controls that have a server implementation and a client implementation as two separate pieces that talk together. So the way to do that is we have a base template class that then you can put any ASCX over it. So you can define your UI and then have the server control that, you know, understands those controls and how to initialize certain things. And then you implement iScript control and you get methods such as get script descriptors and get script references. So that keeps track of what scripts do I need to run this control. And what things to describe the control do I need to know on the client? So you can add references to other components, just individual properties for different strings or whatever you need on the client, and
And the client IDs and elements.
Yeah,
I mean the get descriptors gives you all the individual client side IDs of the elements in your control so that you can reference them using script. So.
Yep. So. What that does then is then ASP.NET has a way to understand that this control needs references added and stuff like that onto the page. So then at render time, it calls out to your control and says, okay, what script references do you need that you told me about? And it will add them all for every control onto the page. We then use Telerik Script Combiner, although we don't have to in .NET 3.5 SP1 because they built it into their script manager. It'll actually combine them into one request because it gets expensive, which Nathan can talk about all the optimizations we did JavaScript-wise because he did pretty much all that. So then in your JavaScript file, you basically follow the same OOP model that you do on the server. You build out a class and you define, you know, all those properties that you define on the server. Find them in your class, and those get set when the app loads on the client, and then you just do your work and have things talk to each other. So, you know, we call out to web services and things like that. So that
excellent.
So one of the things that happens with this is we end up having to do our data binding in two different places. It doesn't have to happen twice on a normal load, but what happens is we write a JavaScript version of data binding, which sometimes uses just binding property to element, and it does it all for us, or we actually have to write script to do it. But then we also write a server-side data bind. And the reason for that is if you view something like the coffee house, when page one comes up, when you hit the coffee house, we server-side bind all of those elements on the page. And that works just like a normal ASP.NET control. It calls the data bind method. We set all the properties. But then when you click to go to page two, all the HTML is already there. You know, all of the divs and all the anchor tags and everything are already sitting there. So then JavaScript is used to rebind them all to new data.
Nice.
So because of that, if you went pure Ajax, where every page load, even the first, was asynchronous, you'd write one data bind, the JavaScript. By any time we want a control that works in both places, then we end up having to write it twice. It's not ideal, I suppose, but it's very common if you want basically the option of server-side or client-side loading a control.
We got a lot of feedback from the miners that they did not like initial client loads, so
yeah,
we got rid of it and went. But it makes it so we have to do it twice, but it's not that bad.
But you don't need the next page's data until you want it.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's actually, it makes sense.
It does. The interesting downfall of that is now that the page has to be reloaded more often. So the data changes, like in the coffee house. So mm-hmm. you go to the initial coffee house page. All that data is different constantly, so you have to get the HTML for the entire page a lot.
Unless you click refresh. Right. I mean, so once you actually are viewing that page, we do have a refresh button in the entry list itself, so not the browser refresh. If you do that, it's basically doing client-side, an Ajax load of even page one again for you.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, I mean, in terms of speed, you're transferring, I mean, Nathan did the numbers, the data difference of loading the entire first page versus loading just the entry list contents on each subsequent page load, it's an enormous difference in how much data has to come down across the wire.
Mm.
And that's really the point and the benefit of Ajax, I think, is that instead of getting the entire new page again, you get just, you know, a few K of data. And then, and since we're doing the data binding on the client, you don't even have to send down HTML again, you just send down pure data, and we have a little XML document at the bottom that specifies the bindings, basically. For this control, hook up this field's value with this, you know, like inner HTML of a span or a div or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very minimal, the amount of data that goes back and forth.
Excellent. So this is really JSON, right?
It is. Yeah, it's JSON. And this is probably a good segue.
And this is Jason.
To Nathan talking about what we did around performance of that data going back.
This is Nathan.
So
that's
Nathan.
I get it.
Not Jason.
Wait a minute. Where am I? Oh, here we are. So let's talk about that. You did the fun work of optimizing JScript, man.
Yeah, and the page in general. Just a lot of readjusting things, repositioning, making sure everything that can be gzipped from the server is, so everything comes across really small.
And then you blow it, and then you expand it on the client.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Clients I can.
So let's talk, what are some of the like basic pitfalls that you've seen in the code that would cause it to be non-performant or not as performant as it could be?
It's looking pretty good.
No?
Yeah.
So you crunched the JavaScript,
that's
one thing, and the CSS.
So it's crunched in the build. CSS is crunched in the build. So when it's combined, all the crunch versions are combined.
Mm-hmm.
It's the request, there's a handler that's compressing everything that's requested, except for RE6, because that still has some issues potentially.
Mm.
I think with XAML, we don't compress either.
XAML.
That's only as of like 2 weeks ago.
Don't anymore.
That's true.
We ran into a bug where, for some reason, we gzipped the XAML in the when we sent it back to the browser, and sometimes, very hard to repro, sometimes the browser would not decompress it correctly. So, which suggests it was being compressed incorrectly, but we could never really get it to happen on a reliable basis. So, we've just turned off compression for XAML files specifically now, so they come down in their full size.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we don't know why.
Huh. That's for the Silverlight player, obviously.
Yeah, so we'll just have to switch to Silverlight 2 and get out of the
sending just straight sample down business.
Excellent. Send binary down, huh?
Yeah.
Good.
Hopefully once.
Cool. So, you guys spend half your time in C#, or I don't know, you do a lot of SQL, a lot of Transact SQL, don't you?
Not as much as I used to, but whenever we would get the email that the database server was going crazy or things were running slow, I would fire up the, like the, I would fire up the
profiler.
There yeah. you go. Yeah. Fire up the profiler and look and see what the requests were. Get kind of the worst offenders when it came to stored procedures, and then I'd look at query plans in the management studio.
Sure.
And mostly because my SQL was pretty weak when I came here. I remember actually when I was getting interviewed, Eric asked me a question, and I didn't know the difference between inner and outer joins, and so
it's a hard question, Eric.
That's what I told myself too. But anyway, so I got this a SQL book from MS Press, and read it on a plane when I was going back home for something, I can't remember what, and just kind of read it on the bus and out of work and stuff, and said, "Hey, this SQL's not that bad." And so then after that, I kind of dove in and started trying some of the optimization stuff, and it's actually pretty fun because it's like logic problem solving. You're trying to figure out like, okay, well, but if I can put an index on this table, then this, you know, hash join can become an inner join. Like I can, you know, find the worst parts of the query and then optimize them. But sometimes when you make a change, it changes the way SQL figures out how it wants to run the query and then does something completely different. And it's kind of a fun little balancing act of figuring out trying to write really tight SQL and with the right set of indexes that don't kill your perf because there's too many, but are enough to ensure that the queries that you run a lot run fast.
Excellent.
Cool. Yeah,
that's fine. So, I mean, I would just go back to, like, the whole link thing, right? And link to SQL is just one flavor of link.
It
is. Integrated query that I think people get confused if that's what link is.
Sure.
But in this case, link to SQL doesn't help you optimize poor query performance on the server. What it does is it lets you write C# interact.
And Eric and I have done this a couple of times. Link SQL actually writes pretty good SQL, and we've actually a couple of times built like some, like use the data designer to build like a couple of our, like we'll drag our tables in and stuff, and we'll just write what we mean in C#, and then hook up the debugger and see what kind of SQL Link's writing.
Nice.
And use it. We can't use it verbatim because it's optimizing way more than we can, like it's stripping things out that we need. But sometimes we've looked to it for inspiration. Yes.
That's awesome, man. Cool.
So in general, I think our attitude when Link came out across the board, I don't speak for everybody, but we looked at it, it's like, oh, it's gonna generate SQL for you and it's gonna be fairly generic, in which case it won't be fast. And we're not going to use it. We're hardcore. We're going to do all our own stored procs. We're going to, you know, we're going to make sure that they are fast enough ourselves. We're not going to use their auto-generated crap. So we have a start out with that attitude about a lot of things where they do all the work for you. You sort of assume it's not going to be as good as if you put the work in to do it all manually.
Yeah.
And then as we started using it, and we started using it for objects a lot. Anytime we had to do set manipulation on collections, it's a lot easier to do link than to do a for each loop and break at the right times. And it becomes a lot more elegant to use link.
Cool.
And then we started trying link to SQL for some of our internal tools, because it's quicker than trying to reference all of the EvNet code base. We just fire up link, and it was really fast. And so we started doing some tests around it. We realized that I believe in a few cases it was a tiny bit slower than what we were doing, but considering it was completely generic and you could add the operators and things like that, it's like, well, for the benefits you get of being able to request only the data you want, the SQL it produces is really impressive.
So hey, man, look, conversion has happened, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, we did start out.
Link naysayers are now sayers.
Another example of Sampy buying a book and reading it on the bus.
Right on,
guys.
Yeah,
Eric and everybody will be proud. So the Niners have a bunch of questions, and you started that thread, Mr. Porter. Let's take a look at it, and let's start. Okay. Let's get the Niners involved in this conversation.
Should we post in the thread that we're reading the thread and filming it?
Yes, filming right now. Perfect. Install Silverlight, Duncan.
I like to see what it looks like without without Silverlight on, so that people know. Okay, what do we got going on here? So Eric promising and things that we're not necessarily going to do.
Yeah.
Okay, like so the first set of questions, what does your test process look like? That's a good question.
By Mattis Mathis.
So, test. Yeah, that's interesting. We don't do.
You don't have a test.
We don't really have a test team. Well, we don't have a test team. We don't have any testers. Sometimes we like to say the Niners are our test team, and they, I'm sure, don't appreciate that. for the most part, we do what I would call acceptance testing, where we build it. We do have a staging server. We look at it ourselves. We pass it amongst ourselves. We look through the feature. We go through in dev and add threads and do all the things that we think are test. Obviously, the people who understand testing realize that, you know, manual, random testing like that never covers.
Sure.
Anywhere.
Well, do you write unit tests? In your...
We write some.
Yeah.
There's a few by three of us, and there's a bunch by Sampy. But even even Sampy's, to be clear, it covers such a small percentage of our code that it's, I wouldn't want to claim to anyone that we do unit testing.
Mm-hmm.
And we. We're interested in improving that, you know, but for the most part, and this is something that we were talking about actually in response to some of the discussions on this thread, we're not staffed or organized in such a way that test and release quality is of the priority it would be on some place like Microsoft.com or even MSDN.
Mm-hmm.
And if it was going to be, if we were going to sort of switch around to where we don't want any downtime, we never want to release anything unless it's been completely tested and signed off by a test manager, we would have to completely and utterly re-architect the team with more people.
Mm-hmm.
And also, even if with the people we have, we would probably have to switch to like a every 3 months release model, a test pass, specific people assigned to testing. And right now, at least in the people above me, I think we like our ability to deploy on a daily basis
when
something comes up as you know, a key part of the team. So
totally.
I've worked on both kinds. I've worked on teams where, well, I look at MSDN where we built MSDN 2 and I think it took 3 years before they got rid of MSDN 1 versus this team where I see stuff go up that we coded, you know, that morning. And then that's more when I started here, and now we're a bit better. It's really at the end of sprints. We tend to deploy things, so there's like a 2 week window for deploying fixes. So there's a wide range. And all I'll say is that like if someone was to decide the most important thing about Channel 9 is that it's reliable and never goes down, that can be accomplished, but it would be a radically different site and a radically different team building it. So.
Cool.
But continuing along.
Great answer.
How much of the classic ASP.NET framework do you still use? So I'm assuming not, as in what do we use out of .NET that we didn't have to rewrite ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
Tons. I mean, the base of ASP.NET is still the page framework and all the work it does for you with handlers and things like that. Everything we do is based on that. What we've done ourselves, we kind of redid the theming model so that we decide what CSS gets included and what doesn't. And part of that goes to our desire to have one web project, multiple sites.
Mm-hmm.
But it also goes to the performance of wanting to crunch our own CSS and do combining of the CSS. But for the most part, I mean, ASP.NET is the underlying platform, and we use every bit of it we can. As new things come out, there's stuff we wrote ourselves that didn't exist when we wrote it,
mm-hmm.
that we could probably switch to using things in like 3.5, 3.5 SP1. We do all of our own URL routing. We have our own entire set of code for that, and they've just released URL routing built into the framework.
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth the effort to rip out what we did just to switch to theirs? Maybe. You know, mm-hmm. but it definitely, like if we were starting now, we would just use that. So.
Sure.
So anyways, everything we do is built on ASP.NET.
Cool. And do you guys use generics?
Oh yeah.